From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. We are all better than our worst decision. That's the message of The Master Plan, a memoir by Chris Wilson. At 17, Wilson was sentenced for murder to life in prison. Behind bars, he reflected on his troubled upbringing and focused on building a positive future. Wilson details his improbable path to freedom and the challenges he's faced since returning home.
As an entrepreneur, when I first started my company, it affected my ability to gain a line of credit, even though my business was profitable. Folks are reluctant to take a chance with people like myself because of like what we've been through and because of how society, at least in America, how we label people who are returning home from prison.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at WYPR.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@WYPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Remorse isn't feeling bad about what you've done. Remorse is bigger. It is acknowledging that you did something irrevocably wrong, followed by the overwhelming feeling you need to dedicate your life to making up for that sin. Those are the words of Chris Wilson, who at 17 was sentenced to life in prison for murder. In 2012, he was released from prison. Since then, he studied at the University of Baltimore, been honored at the White House, and founded several businesses, including the Barclay Investment Corporation, a residential and commercial contracting firm. His memoir, written with Brett Witter, is The Master Plan, My Journey from Life in Prison to a Life of Purpose. On Saturday at 7 p.m., Wilson will speak at a free Ivy Bookshop event hosted by the Church of the Redeemer. Chris Wilson, welcome to On the Record.
Thanks for having me.
You grew up in Washington, D.C., in a rough neighborhood straddled by housing projects, and by the eighth grade, you stopped attending school regularly. What was your home life like when you were in your teens?
My home life in my teens was a bit difficult, mostly because of my mom's relationship with her boyfriend at the time, who was a police officer. So it was a lot of abuse at home that I witnessed and that I experienced. And I think I got suspended from school. So I was doing my schoolwork from home mostly. And so I was in the house and I had to just witness a lot of bad stuff.
Stuff like you saw people getting shot?
Well, people were getting shot all the time outside. But the worst of it was watching my mom be physically abused by her boyfriend. And so he would beat her up in front of me often. Or verbally abuse her, and so that was pretty tough for me.
How did you cope with the violence that you witnessed in the neighborhood and in your home?
Well, I would try to avoid it as much as possible, but I mostly just read books, and I use books as a way to escape my reality outside. And when I read these books, I would just imagine that I was, you know, somewhere else, living a different life.
But in your life, you started carrying guns.
Yes.
That was one of the only ways you felt safe, and carrying a gun then led you to shoot and kill a man after he and his friend followed and threatened you. Tell us about that night.
So, the decision to carry the gun is like after a certain point of watching all my friends, five, I believe, before the age of 17, be killed and gunned down. Two of them were gunned down in front of me. And then watching my mom being abused, and it was like a feeling of feeling helpless. And then oftentimes we would call the police, like when stuff happened, and they would either show up like 30 minutes late or they wouldn't show up at all. And so at a certain point, I just felt like I just need to protect myself, or I need to be able to protect my mom next time she's attacked. And so I started carrying a weapon. And at this point, you know, I had lost family members. My brother had been shot. My cousin had been killed. And one night, you know, men in their 30s, they came after me and surrounded me and were threatening me. And, you know, I made a decision, you know, a bad decision. And I ended up taking a person's life. And I was 17. I was charged as an adult. And I was sentenced to natural life in prison.
Natural life in prison. What was the political atmosphere then? I mean, was there any prospect that you would be released without spending your life in prison?
There was no prospect. And in the state of Maryland, at least, when someone sentenced to life.
And that's where the crime took place.
Yes, in Prince George's County. So in the state of Maryland, if you're sentenced to life in prison, even with the possibility of parole, you don't get it. Because most people in the state of Maryland don't never get granted parole. So either way you look at it, life without parole or with parole, it's a slow death sentence.
That's entrepreneur Chris Wilson here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. Wilson's memoir, The Master Plan, details his difficult experiences in prison and how after his release he became a positive force in Baltimore's Barclay neighborhood. Okay, so listeners must be thinking, wait a minute, he's sitting in a radio studio talking to Sheila. He must have at some point been released. Let's walk through some of those years. About 18 months in your sentence, you wrote The Master Plan. What is this plan?
The plan is essentially a plan for me to turn my life around. And one of the biggest questions I had to ask myself is, who is the person that I want to become? What's my end game? I knew I was a good person. I wanted to start a business one day. It was things that I wanted to do in my life that I just used to think about. And so I thought about who I could be, who I could become, and then I just worked backwards. I'm like, what do I need to do every day in order to become that person? So a lot of it involved education. A lot of it involved therapy to figure out what led me to prison. And then other things were like places that I wanted to visit, people that I wanted to meet. And then, you know, I wrote it when I was 19, so it was some silly stuff on it, food that I wanted to try, and like I wanted to buy my dream car and like, you know, all stuff like that. And so that's essentially what the master plan is, and it applies to anyone. It's about not being happy where you are in life and then brainstorming and think about where you want to be in life and how do you work towards achieving your goals.
But you are behind bars with a life sentence.
Yes.
And your perception of that is that
right.
It's a life sentence. How could you have the kind of hope
right.
that would lead you to write such a list?
So I in the book I write, I call it a positive delusion. And so I just had to delude myself and believe that I would be free one day. And if I believed that it would happen, then I felt like, well, I have to be prepared for when it does happen. And yeah, I think I kind of like got this from a book that I read about John McCain when he was locked up in Vietnam. And it was a guy next door to him who would convince everyone. They were locked up for a couple of years in Hanoi Hilton. And he would say, look, we're going home by December. And they knew they wasn't going home, but they kind of just brought into it. And it's like, if we just think that we're going home in December, maybe the time wouldn't be so tough. And so I had read this book around this time, and I was like, well, I just gotta believe that I'm going home. And if I believe it, then, you know, I just gotta work. I gotta be ready when it happens. And there were times when there was doubt, but like it happened, and it was beautiful.
So walk us through the early steps in the plan that you devised. What were some of the first big things you needed to do, and how did you do them?
The first thing that was on the list, well, one of the things was to stop calling home. And so
stop,
I write about
this. Stop calling home.
Stop calling home.
Because?
Right? So I would call home a lot or try to call friends when I first was incarcerated, and no one would pick up the phone. And it was just this thing. I would wait in line to use the phone, and no one would pick up. And I just remember that feeling of like being shut off from the outside world. And it was painful. But I would always try to call, hoping like that maybe this day will be different. It's like, you know, a year would go by, months and months. And I was like, maybe they'll pick up the day. And one of the things was just like, I just gotta cut off the outside world and focus on my education. I knew I was book smart. I knew I was intelligent. But no one else knew. And so part of the plan was like, I want to prove to myself and prove to everyone else that, you know, I went in as a child. I wanted to prove that my life was redeemable and that I was intelligent and that I could contribute to society. And so I just started studying like rigorously every day, reading everything. And I got my high school diploma in 2 months. And then I went on just to tackle everything that was available.
Which included college.
So, yeah, college. I did all the vocational shops. I got into college, and college was the point that really opened my mind to the real world. And my professors were very strict with me. And, you know, they would come in sometimes and say, listen, you don't have anything but time. And so you shouldn't get anything wrong. You should, like, your grammar, like do it over. And I used to be like, yeah, they're right. So, I mean, it really pushed me to be a very, strong student and a learner.
How long did it take you to get a college degree?
So I went part-time. When I started out, I worked two jobs while I was going to school. So I think I did it in like 2 years, 2 or 3 years. And so I got a degree in sociology. And then after I graduated, there were still college classes available. So I just took every class that was available. And then when there were no classes, I just ordered books and just read every book I can find. And then started my own language and study groups and real estate and entrepreneurial stuff.
We need to take a quick break here. We're talking to Chris Wilson, an entrepreneur and advocate for prison reform, who is speaking about his memoir, The Master Plan. He'll be at the Church of the Redeemer on Saturday evening. When we come back, life after prison. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us on The Record.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. Attend weekly therapy and resolve my issues. Start my own business that makes a difference in people's lives. Always seek advice. Get my sentence modified to 20 years. Those are some of the goals achieved by entrepreneur and prison reform advocate Chris Wilson. His new memoir, The Master Plan, written with Brett Witter, details his troubled upbringing and the 16 years he spent behind bars. So let's pick up the story. Even though you were able to get your associate's degree, to start a photography service, to create a book club, you constantly ran into barriers in prison. Describe some of the ways prison stifled your efforts to improve yourself.
Well, I think one of the things that will constantly happen, and it still happens behind the fence, is the rules. Like, the rules will constantly change. There were constant memos of, like, you can't do this, you can't do that, and in school. And we had college program that I really, really enjoyed. You know, the college program was cut out. I guess, like, some folks felt that, you know, we shouldn't be have access to a college education. So there were things like that. There was an increase in violence in the prison system because of, like, an influx of gangs that were all throughout the prison. And so it was just navigating. It was kind of like being in another planet. And it was just different rules. And you also had to kind of desensitize yourself to, like, what was happening around you. Like, folks were being stabbed around me. Some folks had been killed. And you would see stuff, like, happen around you. And, like, these were people. But I wanted to go home. And so I minded my business and just focused on my plan and kept my head down. But it was tough. I mean, it was tough because, you know, you saw people being hurt around you, or you just saw stuff that just wasn't fair. And, you know, it's just stuff that, you know, that stuck with me.
Tell us about the photo service you and a partner started as a business.
Yeah, so me and my cell buddy, we had, like, magazine subscriptions and newspaper subscriptions. And so we would get a subscription to Popular Science. And our thing was, we wanted to keep an eye on emerging technology. And we remember reading one day, it was like digital cameras where you can print a picture. And I was like, what? You can print a picture? We had Polaroid cameras at the time. And I was like, I can't believe this. And I knew that, you know, my mom taught me this when I was young, just like, as an entrepreneur, you look for opportunities, new ideas, and try to build upon, like, existing technology. So we had these Polaroid cameras, and the photos didn't always come out well. It was expensive. We were losing money. We had an inmate welfare fund account, and it was just dwindling in money because we were wasting it on the photography film. And so my cell buddy and I proposed to start a digital photography business. And so we put together a proposal that we felt would be profitable, and we pitched it to the administration, and they accepted it. I guess that was technically like my first entrepreneurial pursuit. So it was exciting.
And at some point, the profits built up to $20,000 in the fund.
Yeah, well, it went more than that. It went up to like $40,000, double that. But like around like in 18 months, we got it up to about $20,000 in inmate welfare fund account.
But there was a bitter lesson there too.
Yes. And so I'm trying to think of the appropriate term. The funds were reappropriated, I think. At first they were earmarked into another account and then reappropriated to buy security cameras for the prison. Yes. So I was very upset about that.
What did you take away from that experience?
So I'm the type of person that always looks at the bright side of things. And so what I took away from it was I was capable of starting a business that made a difference in people's lives. Like I was holding events to get family members to come in and people to take photos with their families and stuff like that. I was able to create something that generated a profit. Although like the money was taken away from me, from us, from the institution. But that's the takeaway from it. It's like I was able to brainstorm, do my research, and create something that was profitable, that people liked and enjoyed. And so that gave me confidence that if I was able to become free, that I could do it again.
Eventually, you were granted a rare opportunity, a hearing.
Yes.
The judge modified your sentence, which in combination with your credits for good behavior allowed you to be released in 2012. What do you remember about that hearing?
I remember being terrified. I call it the biggest job interview of my life. And so I just remember my heart just beating like really fast. And I was scared. But at the end of the day, what I felt was like, I just want to be honest. I'm going to just tell the truth. I know I'm a good person. I've been working really hard. I hadn't gotten in any trouble. I was striving to educate myself as much as possible. So I said, if there is a God, I was thinking about like God a lot at this moment. And it's like, maybe like this will be a sign that like everything that I've been doing for the previous 10 years was the right thing. And it was recognized by the courts.
When you went back to prison that day, what was it like to share that news with your friends?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, even the correctional officers were cheering for me. It was like we had won the Super Bowl. I was walking down the hallways, and people were screaming. It was rattling the cells and the doors. It was an amazing feeling. And most importantly, because everyone saw how hard I worked through all those years. And it was confirmation for many people, including the correctional administration, that, hard work pays off.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass speaking with Chris Wilson. He's written a memoir about the murder conviction that sent him to prison, his 16 years there, and how he went on to attend University of Baltimore, start his own business, and work to place those facing barriers to employment in jobs. How did your criminal record affect your ability to build a new life on the outside?
That was one of my biggest concerns, even before I got out of prison. And for most prisoners, you think about like, what is the path to reacclimate into society? Are people going to judge me because of a mistake I made when I was young, right? And which they do, right? And it happens to many men and women all around the country. And so I was able to understand that the number one way how one will find a job is through relationships. And so even before I came home, I worked very hard at building relationships, writing my professors and school administrators and any like positive person that I knew. And it was still difficult. But when I came home, I think I was able to get a job in about 2 months. And it was through relationships. I went to the University of Baltimore and got enrolled, and I would ask the professors, do you know anyone that's hiring? And most of them, usually they would say like, no, I don't really like know anyone, but I just kept working my network. And then I was able to get a job interview, and I just prepared and prepared and prepared for this job interview. And by the grace of God, I was able to get a chance to prove that I could do the job.
Do you feel a stigma as an ex-convict today, even with all you've achieved?
Well, I do. Even the term ex-convict is painful for us coming home just to be referred to is that it makes it difficult for us to reacclimate as citizens and just like and just to move forward. As an entrepreneur, when I first started my company, you know, it affected my ability to gain a line of credit, even though my business was profitable. Folks are reluctant to take a chance with people like myself because of like what we've been through and because of how society, at least in America, how we label people returning home from prison. So it's just tough. It's tough for everyone. And most of it is psychological. Even for my families, you know, I came home when I was 32. And I was a 32-year-old man who didn't have a job, didn't have a car, and, like, didn't have anything to my name. And so, like, it's something that, like, really, like, bothered me psychologically and bothers many other people. And so it's just tough.
Early in your incarceration, your family, as you mentioned, broke ties with you. But that rejection didn't stop you from reaching out to others. You became an outreach worker in Baltimore's Barclay neighborhood with the organization Strong City.
Yes.
What did that job entail?
So I started doing that work as a community organizer and doing workforce development in the Barclay neighborhood. And it's wonderful because the executive director Karen Stokes, actually saw like my past and my experience as an asset to the organization. She actually pushed me beyond what I thought I was capable of as a person. I mean, we worked on our days off. We worked like after hours, and it was all like community stuff. And so organizing, meeting with church members, meeting with gang members, business owners, and doing workshops. And so it was the perfect job for me to prove that, you know, I could get it done. And so I learned a ton of things working there. And I still stop by there every now and then and hug everyone. And just like a beautiful organization.
You've gone on to start your own businesses, Barclay Investment Corporation, which does residential and commercial contracting, and a high-end furniture company. What drives you to be an entrepreneur?
I like to create stuff. But not just create stuff. I like to make people's lives better or make the world just a little better than it was the day before. And so even with the contracting business, there would be times where maybe it'd be a little bit of work and then maybe I could make some money. But I was more focused on making sure all of my people stayed employed and that it was all about them. And I actually never took a salary from my companies. And so I wanted to make either the environment or people's lives better. And so that's what drives me. I just want to pay it forward. And, you know, I feel blessed to be free. And so I just want to show my appreciation to the world by helping other people.
You write that people ask, how can we make more Chris Wilsons? And your response is that we have to actually want more Chris
right.
Wilsons. Explain that.
So that's a very important point or just something, at least to me, is that people will read about my story and say, like, that it's remarkable and that I'm special, and I'm not. It's Chris's everywhere. I've met people like me all over the country. A lot of people like me still behind the fence when I go into the prisons and meet them. I've only made it this far because a handful of people saw potential in me, even when I didn't see it in myself, and they mentored me, and they pushed me, and they screamed at me, but it came from, like, a place of love, and I was able to make it this far. And it's the same way today. Like, I have advisors, I have people in my life that will call me, that we have meetings, and they really support me. And I like to imagine a world where everyone had or knew a Chris in their life that they took the extra time, like, to push and mentor them. Like, I think it would change the world. We would live in a different world.
So what's next? What's your end game now?
My end game is I recently started painting. So about 2 years ago, I started painting and doing shows and doing stuff all around the world, in Paris and Italy and South America and stuff here in Baltimore. But I want to get into philanthropy. And it's something that, you know, if done right, is powerful. And I kind of want to do it, like, quietly. I started my own foundation, Chris Wilson Foundation, here in Baltimore. I started a Chris Wilson scholarship at my university that supports inmates working towards their college degree in Jessup, Maryland. It's called the Second Chance College Program through the University of Baltimore. And so I've been doing that. And I feel like my role is I just want to be behind the scenes making art and using any resources that I have to support the other Chris's of the world or people that's supporting other Chris's. And so I just want to do that.
Good luck.
Thank you.
And congratulations on this book.
Thank you so much.
Chris Wilson's memoir, written with Brett Witter, is The Master Plan. Saturday at 7 p.m., Chris Wilson will be in conversation about his memoir with Wes Moore at an Ivy Bookshop event at the Church of the Redeemer, 5603 North Charles Street. We have a link at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you've been listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.